come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining out door.
Come over here, kid. Why, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. This is Michelle Anna Jordan. I'll be here with you until 10 minutes to 8 o'clock when we will hear from Laura Hager, Mouthful's wonderful book critic. Did you go to the farmer's market today in Sebastopol? It was a lovely market. I just love this time of year. I love the color and the quality of the light. And as I walked through the market, beautiful heirloom tomatoes were absolutely everywhere. And they seemed like some of the farmers were setting them out on the table one by one, almost thinking of the way to make them beautiful. They're certainly beautiful in and of themselves, but instead of having them in boxes and baskets, a lot of them had them just set out. And on one hand, it made them look just like they'd be here. We'd have them forever. On the other hand, they're so fleeting. By next week, depending on what happens with the weather, they could be gone. They could be gone in 2 weeks or three. Certainly, we're nearing the end of tomato season. And that means a couple of things. It means eat your last BLTs before Ms. Mouthful won't allow you to eat anymore because you won't have local tomatoes. But also, you might want to think about preserving them. If I were forced to preserve just one seasonal thing, it would be tomatoes. Certainly, you can buy really good canned tomatoes, and that's what you want to use during the off-season. But having your own tomatoes, seasonal, you know, the ones grown in your backyard or neighbor's backyard or from the farmer's market, and freezing them, and perhaps doing it in such a way that you make tomato concassé, which is really just peeled and seeded tomatoes that's chopped up and drained a little bit. Freezing them gives you some other options. They're really good. You can make wonderful tomato soups and sauces in the middle of winter. So how to preserve the harvest, not just tomatoes, but lots of other things, is our topic this evening. And on that note, I would like to introduce somebody who does really, really great work in Sonoma County, especially Western Sonoma County, Wendy Krupnik, organic farmer, gardener, and instructor, and a passionate advocate for a lot of things I care about. Welcome to Mouthful.
Thank you, Anna. Michelle.
It's okay. You just did, about 10 days ago, you did a workshop on preserving at Sebastopol Hardware?
Yeah. It was lots of fun. It was actually the second. They had asked me early in the season if I might do this, and I said, well, I'm not a culinary instructor, but I've been preserving food for a long time, and they said, that would be great. And I discovered that they have this incredible selection of canning supplies, especially jars, and they do this wonderful service to the community of having these free evening seminars where people come in and learn whatever, and then they have 20% off on whatever product it is that they're featuring that evening.
And so, and I guess you had a really good turnout, right?
Yeah. It was fabulous.
It was like 100 people or something.
It seemed like it, yeah. They were standing and sitting in the aisles and everything.
And what could you tell from the audience? Were they people coming because they had a lot of things they wanted to preserve?
I got that impression. I think I asked how many people had gardens, and almost everybody raised their hands. So, and I think that that's really where some of the impetus for preserving comes from, because if you have a garden, you know that there's times when it just cranks and there's no way you can use all of it just fresh. So we'd like to kind of hold on to it. Right, that people want to learn. Maybe people have had a little bit of experience, some successes, some failures. They've done some things, but they're kind of intimidated, especially people are intimidated about canning.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people came to learn.
So, let's walk through the process of canning, sort of the basic 101.
Okay.
Do people really need to know?
Well, a couple things people need to know. One is they need to know about high-acid foods and low-acid foods. And they need to know about what temperatures, what organisms are killed at. They need to know about the equipment that they need to have. And then once they kind of get all that, look at some recipes, then just being really well organized. So when I did this last one at Sebastopol Hardware, the previous time I started with freezing and drying, and we didn't have enough time for canning. So this time I wanted to make sure I covered canning from the get-go, because there's a lot of interest in that. So... first of all, understanding that preserving the harvest is about having the product at optimal quality flavor-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing, I differ with some of the books. Books say things like the produce has to be absolutely perfect, free of blemishes and brown spots.
Right.
But, you know, as a farmer, I sell my firsts, eat my seconds, and process my thirds, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's true that you don't want any actual spoiled anything in your preserved product, because that would ruin the flavor. But certainly bird pecks or whatever, you can pare them out. And as mm-hmm. long as you work quickly, then you can take product with really good quality. So, but then knowing that there's bacteria, molds, fungi, and you want to kill all those.
Mm-hmm.
So certain temperatures are needed in order to kill things, and that depends on whether it's a acid food or a non-acid food, because you need much higher temperatures to kill these nasty organisms with non-acid foods. So first of all, what's what? What's an acid mm-hmm. food? What's a non-acid food? And this is where the reference books really come in handy. So everybody has to have a reference book, and there's a lot of them out there. So of course, acid foods like you would think would be things like lemons and the stone fruit. Some people don't realize that all of the apricots and plums and peaches and cherries, all of those are acid foods. Berries are all acid foods. Things like apples and pears. But where it gets interesting is with tomatoes, because mm-hmm. Tomatoes are actually an acid food, but mm-hmm. the magic pH is 4.6. With 1 being really acid and then 14 being really neutral or alkaline and 7 being neutral,
mm-hmm.
totally neutral. What did I say? I should have said basic or alkaline. But anyway, 7 is neutral. So at 4.6 is acid. But nowadays, they say that some types of tomatoes are not acid enough. So all the recommendations are to acidify the tomatoes a little bit for canning. So that means that the temperatures that we use for open kettle canning or steam canning are adequate for killing all these organisms for acid foods. So in order to do the canning with tomatoes, we need to acidify them just a teeny bit.
And that means adding a little lemon juice, for example?
A little lemon juice or a little citric acid or a little vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting, though, is, again, looking at all these reference books, they vary a little bit in terms of how much. Because
mm-hmm.
I've seen as little as like 2 teaspoons per quart and as much as 2 tablespoons per quart. So,
and at 2 tablespoons per quart, you're really going to start influencing the flavor.
Yes, you are. And so you can use something like citric acid instead, which is more kind of flavor neutral.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can buy it.
You can, yeah.
Yeah, little crystals.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's one concern, is the adding that teeny bit of acidity when you're doing tomatoes. And then for non-acid foods like vegetables, that's when you need to either acidify them majorly, like pickling them, you know, putting them in vinegar,
mm-hmm.
or use a pressure canner. And I hope we aren't going to talk about pressure canning, because I don't do it.
Okay. Well, we're going to be doing a program on pressure cooking.
Oh, with Jill?
Yeah, coming up. And I'm a great advocate of cooking with a pressure cooker.
Great.
I love it.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be doing that as we get a little bit further into the cold months.
All right.
Maybe sometime in November, so we'll see about that then.
Perfect. All right. So then once you know, like, what's an acid food and what's a non-acid food, then you start to look at what your equipment needs to be. So you need certain types of jars for canning. They need to obviously be, you know, heat-proof. So we buy these canning jars. And most of this equipment is a great initial investment, but then, you know, obviously things like your canning kettle you can keep reusing, but the jars you can keep reusing too. And I was just thinking this afternoon, one of the few things that we just kind of share and share alike in the community, in our family and friends, are canning jars.
Yeah, that's really true.
We give them as gifts, mm-hmm. and they come back to us, and I almost never run out. But I was in a little bit of a panic 2 days ago because I was finally getting ready to make blackberry jam, and I didn't have any more of the really cute ones because I've given them all away. And mm-hmm. I had, you know, a number of half-pint and 12-ounce jars, which I like to use for jam, but I only had one of those cute little fat ones.
I love those fat ones, the wide mouth.
Me too.
The wide mouth half pint. Those are my favorites.
Yeah, yeah. So, but anyway, I found enough. But I thought, gee, I need to, like, get some of the people I've been giving gifts to give some of them back to me.
You know, and every now and then you can go on a local website. There's the West County WackoBB.net.
That's true.
And you'll see people saying either they want canning jars, they're selling canning jars, or they're giving away canning jars if you'll come pick them up.
And thrift stores, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. So anyway, so we got to get our jars, and you have to have a canning kettle. So in terms of doing this kind of canning, you've got two choices. There's the open kettle, or you can use a steam canner. And I use a steam canner. I really prefer it because it uses a lot less water.
Could you explain how it works
and
what it looks like?
It looks like an upside-down canning kettle to some extent because it's got a little shallow part at the bottom mm-hmm. where the water goes. It's like an inch of water and then a rack. And then your jars sit on that rack over the boiling water, and the big hood
sits
over it.
Okay.
So it's so it's the steam, and steam is as hot as boiling water, so it works just as well. And I know that there was this USDA for a while said, oh, I'm not sure if steam canning is fine, but they still sell them. They haven't banned them, and I've been using mine for 25 years, and mm-hmm. it works great.
Cool.
So, it uses less energy because you don't have to boil as much water.
Right.
And it's like less
heavy
that's to slop
I've
around.
I've never used
kind of
one,
thing.
But that's really a great idea.
I love my steam counter. And also the one I bought years ago is enameled, and all the ones I see now are kind of this thin aluminum, and I really like mine.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so the idea is that you prepare your jars. I always start with the jars because you have to end with putting the product in the jars, and you want them to be completely ready. So mm-hmm. you pull your jars out, you inspect them and make sure there's no cracks or nicks or anything like that, wash them. And then most of the directions say that you need to sterilize them first. Not some of them say that for things like jam, you don't need to pre-sterilize them. Mm-hmm. You just need to make sure that they're clean. But I always do. I always wash them again, even though I put them away clean. I wash them again, and mm-hmm. I put them in my steam canner, turn them on, get them hot in there, and then just let them sit hot in waiting until I'm ready. Then you need the lids, because one thing you do need to buy every year is new lids, because mm-hmm. there's a little bitty rubber gasket, and that's what's going to create the seal. So you make sure
you shouldn't. You can't reuse those.
You can't reuse those unless you can use them just for storage or something mm-hmm. in the refrigerator, but not for canning.
They're good at use them in spice jars.
Yeah.
I use canning jars for my spice.
Oh, yeah, they're good for everything.
Bulk spices, and you can reuse them that way.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So you've got your rings, you've got your lids, you've got your jars, you get all that together. And then I work on preparing a few other kind of pieces of equipment that are needed. You need to have a funnel, and you need to have these kind of special tongs that you grip onto a mm-hmm. hot jar. That's absolutely essential.
Mm-hmm. I also think you should have two really good, very good white tea towels.
Absolutely.
You know, they just make the whole process so much easier.
Yep.
And you should have some labels
mm-hmm.
and a permanent ink pen to label what you've done.
I totally agree. Those are all essential. The tea towel is used for two different purposes. One is for wiping the rims. Wiping the rims clean after you fill the jars is totally essential. And I usually dip a corner of the tea towel in the hot water where my rings and lids are mm-hmm. sitting. And so I've got hot, damp tea towel to wipe the rims. Actually, one of the books I saw actually said to use a paper towel. It's like,
oh, you get paper towel flakes.
Then you get lint.
Yeah.
Who wants lint in their whatever. Anyway, yeah, tea towel. And then the other one is when you take the jars out after the processing time is done, you use those tongs and you lift them out very carefully, and you have to set them on a dry tea towel on the counter, mm-hmm. or you can put them on a wooden board or something like that, too.
And I even like covering the wooden board with a tea towel.
Oh, okay.
There's just something about... Sometimes, and I had this happen once, it was very sad, I had a whole bunch of jars break.
Oh.
Made the most wonderful applesauce. I do a Zinfandel applesauce.
Oh, yum.
And it's just really a great applesauce, and the jars cracked. And we still don't really know exactly what happened. I
did as you set them on the counter?
Yeah. They might have, it might be that they got, something happened with the temperature.
Wow.
But I always like to have the tea towel, because then if you're,
yeah.
if you're setting it or if it drops from those
mm-hmm.
tongs,
mm-hmm.
if you've got the tea towel, you've got a really good cushion.
That's a really important point. And that's really one of the most vulnerable times is when you're removing that jar from the hot counter and then you set it and it needs to start, that's when the vacuum starts to be created. As that product cooled, and we were talking about this in this class, you know, you hear that plink.
Yes, that
plink,
little
plink.
Plink,
plink. And it's like, it's such a satisfying
it
sound.
It is. And I remember hearing it from at my grandmother's house.
Mm-hmm. With applesauce, it can take a while
yeah.
because there's so much heat. It takes so, it's so dense. It takes a while to cool down. So sometimes I'll go off and do something else, and then, you know, 10 minutes later I'll hear this plink, and the last one can't, you know, seals. It's great. So, yeah, that's what's happening, is that you're creating a vacuum. So the other part that's really important is that after you put your lid on, you put the ring on, and you turn it down hand tight, which is such a subjective
mm-hmm.
measure, how much is hand tight. If you screw it down too tight, then the air can't escape. And if you don't do it tight enough, then sometimes your ingredients bubble out.
Right.
And it's a giant mess yeah. and it's
so
not going to seal either.
Gently but firmly.
Yes. yeah.
It's like, whatever that means.
yeah. It seems pretty straightforward, except if you've never done it before.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of, then there's all kinds of other equipment, but I don't know if we want to talk about
that. That's the main stuff. And then you also need, I think, some sort of guide, a reference book.
Absolutely.
That yeah. tells you how long each type of food needs
mm-hmm.
to be processed for. And processed is simply boiling or steaming.
Right.
The required amount of time.
And that is one thing that's a little trickier with a steam counter, is that you start with boiling, the boiling open kettle method, it's your processing time is when the water starts to boil again. That's pretty straightforward. But with the steam counter, it's when the steam escapes out of that, where the lid fits
mm-hmm.
down on that basin. And sometimes it's hard to see it.
Mm.
You know, it depends on the light
uh-huh.
in your kitchen. And then one of the people who took that class at Sebastopol Hardware said, oh, the stream of steam, I can't believe I actually said that, is supposed to be like 6 inches long. It's like, oh, really? I never heard that before. So I didn't, you know.
Well,
anyway.
That's sort of... Sitting and waiting for a 6-inch long stream of steam, I like that.
But I just do it when it's, you know, when I can see the steam escaping, and sometimes I have to turn off the lights or on the lights or whatever. But that's when your processing time starts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, I found this, which came with a box of Kerr canning jars. You know, one of these charts.
Yeah, they usually have a chart in
yeah.
each container
it
of
has
canning
the basics.
Jars.
But then, of course, then there's all these wonderful books. And, yeah, like you said, you've got
you
to have a
Joy of
Cooking,
book. Which was...
The Joy of Cooking.
I learned so much from that book. I still do. It's
Me
still
too.
One of my main
it's
references.
It's got everything there. And I don't even know, do the new versions have canning and all
you
of that?
You know, I found the newest version so annoying that I admit I don't know.
yeah. Once I heard that they were doing directions for microwave cooking everything, I stopped being interested in the new version.
And too much... California quiz, you know,
oh.
it's like, I want that from other books. I don't want it from Joy of Cooking.
Yeah.
Go away.
Yeah. Yeah.
So one that I really like is Stocking Up.
Yeah.
How to
classic.
Preserve the Foods You Grow Naturally.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good one. Another good one is Putting Food By. That one's been recently revised.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this nice little, it's not actually a little book, Joy of Pickling, 200 recipes for pickling everything in your garden.
Great.
And then you can get a little more foo-foo about it. There's a book, Food for Friends, and it talks not just about canning, but about all baking for friends, that sort of thing. But it does go through a section on preserving foods as gifts
mm-hmm.
and also homemade in the kitchen. So I'm going to post all of these books. I'm going to try to do it on KRCB's Mouthful page. We hope that works. If it doesn't, I'm going to put it up on michelleannajordan.com. I have a page that's called The Latest, and I'll just put a link to all of our resource books.
Yeah, add this one to your list, The Ball Blue Book, because this is also
that's
a
one
classic.
I should have. It
is. And, you know, Lorette Petzwald, she did the one through Community Ed that we did up at Schoen Farm this summer, the workshop on food preserving. We did it last summer, too, and it was really popular, very great. It was fun. Anyway, she turned me on to this one, and it is very comprehensive. It's a great book.
Yeah, I want to add that to my collection as well. You know, one of the things that I think is interesting that we're talking about this right now is that in the wake of the two big hurricanes, every mainstream radio station, you know, the KGO, all the stations, they have guests on to talk about what you need to do for disaster preparedness. And it got me thinking, you know, if anything had happened when I was a little kid, my grandmother's larder would have kept us alive for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't really, most of us don't maintain cupboards like that anymore. So is that one of the things that this makes you feel secure about? Okay, if there's
Absolutely.
An earthquake, I got this happening.
I've felt this way for so many years. I guess when I started canning, and it was tomatoes and salsa were like the first things that I was canning starting in about 85, 86. And after that, I just go like major insecurity. Like I have to make time. Even if I've still got stuff canned from the previous year, I have to always add to it because this is, this is homeland security. This is food security. Having your own food, both in the garden and in the cupboard. And also, as we were saying earlier, this is the original fast food.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that's the one of the advantages of canning is that it can just sit there. It's shelf stable. It doesn't need refrigeration. You know, if the power goes out for a week, you're not going to lose it like all your frozen food.
I know. That's the one thing, because I'm big on freezing certain things, like my tomatoes. But also, I'm like you are, but with frozen stocks.
Mm-hmm.
I have to have frozen beef, chicken, preferably turkey, lamb and stocks, and also fish fumet. If I don't have those things, it's like, oh, gosh, well, what if I want to make fedwa or something?
Yeah, well, then,
But then if the power goes off, then I start worrying about all my stocks.
I know. There's some terrible stories. I'm sure we all know people with terrible stories. Well, for me, the freezing is the pesto because I am so addicted. That's one that I have to do every year. And then the peppers.
Peppers, too. Absolutely.
And that's one of the things I was talking about in that workshop is what different styles or different techniques of preserving for different types of foods. You can do any of it. You can can, freeze, or dry, anything. But I prefer to use one technique with one type of food than another. And so I really like to freeze peppers.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Okay, we're going to take a little musical break, and I'll be right back to talk to you.
Love is a rose, but you better not pick it. It only grows when it's on the vine. Handful of thorns and you know you've missed it. Lose your love when you say the word mine.
You are listening to Mouthful on KRCB, and it's Michelle Jordan, my guest, Wendy Krupnik, who knows how to preserve things because she's been doing it for a long time, and that is really the best way to learn. Those are the people that you want to talk to about how to do it. We have some dried tomatoes here that you're going to tell me about in just a second, but I do have to tell you what happened to me. So excited. We were going through a heat wave. I was living in Cotati, and it was quite a while ago. And it was probably about 95 degrees, and I thought, perfect, I'm making sun-dried tomatoes. And I had screens, and I cut the tomatoes, and they were beautiful tomatoes. And I scooped out the gel and the seeds, and I salted them, and I put them out on the roof of my carport, which was right outside my bedroom window, salted them a little bit, covered them with cheesecloth. They were perfect. And I watched them, and on the second day, the fog came in. And I think it came in while I was asleep. And by morning, They had beautiful green mold over them, and I had to throw them all away.
Oh, dear. That's heartbreaking.
Yeah, so I think you have to be Sacramento, the Central Valley, preferably Sicily, to actually make real sun-dried tomatoes. Most of them are dried. They're dried commercially in a dryer, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm.
That's right. Although you can certainly make a solar dryer, mm-hmm. one that's powered, you know, by the sun rather than electricity. But we're still in Sonoma County where the fog rolls in and it's going to be damp at night and you don't have the sun at night.
Yeah,
so,
and just 6 or 8 hours, 4 hours.
That's right.
With the temperature too low and you get that mold
growing.
With
the humidity, yep. And it's, yeah, they're going to start getting fuzzy. So I finally broke down and bought a dehydrator because I was borrowing one at many places where I, you know, lived for many years. And then when I moved back to Sonoma County, what, almost 10 years ago now, I was like, I guess I'm finally going to buy a dehydrator. And I use it. I mean, this time of year, it just permanently lives in my living room. But even there's other times of the year that I use it as well. And drying is really, in many ways, one of the most, perhaps probably the ancient form of food preserving, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they dried fish, they dried meats, of course your grains were dried, you know, and then, of course, herbs are the easiest thing to dry. You just leave them on your counter, and, you know, they will get crispy. And then you can strip them off the stems and put them in little jars.
Mm-hmm.
And the thin-walled chili peppers can just be air-dried. So there are a number of things that can just kind of be air-dried.
Mm-hmm. And some people will even advise that you pull your last tomatoes when it's starting to get cold. You pull, especially cherry tomatoes, but not big, huge ones,
mm-hmm.
but you pull the tomato plant up by the roots,
mm-hmm.
you turn it upside down and hang it.
And they'll ripen.
On a wall, and they'll ripen, and you'll just be able to pick them off for a
but
few more weeks.
But they won't dry.
No, they won't dry.
No, there's a variety.
That's
Principe
Borghesa, yes.
That's supposed to be, you're supposed to be able to dry them like that, too. You
uh-huh.
know, when I worked for Shepherd's Garden Seeds, we tried all these, I mean, this was the most wonderful thing. I was getting paid to grow all these fabulous varieties from all over the world and learn how to grow them and decide if they were good for home gardeners. And so I remember growing these Principe Borghesa, and, you know, the climate in the Santa Cruz Mountains is almost exactly the same as here. And so, you know, we hang these tomatoes. Oh, they're supposed to dry right on the vine. It's like, yeah, right, just like you. In a few days, you start getting moldy tomatoes.
Yeah. So
it doesn't work here. But
it looks good, though.
But like I said, I use my dehydrator almost all the time, and I discovered this using this particular variety to make dried tomatoes that I just love. And you can see, I dry them pretty darn hard.
Mm-hmm.
They're crunchy.
Mm-hmm.
And
they're
but
good.
That's because I don't want to have to keep them in the freezer or anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when you dry your food, oftentimes the directions will say to kind of a leathery stage, which for eating purposes is nice if you're not going to rehydrate them. But you really need to keep them in the refrigerator or the freezer, or they might start to get moldy.
Mm-hmm.
But I tend to dehydrate things down to a fairly crisp stage,
mm-hmm.
so that if I don't have enough freezer space, I can just keep them someplace else, and they won't, you know, they'll keep well. And what I do with these dried tomatoes, well, I use them for lots of things, but what I love in the wintertime is I make this spread that I use on sandwiches. So I reconstitute the tomatoes just with a little extra moisture in there. And I cut them up first.
Mm-hmm.
And so chop them up, put a little bit of water, bring it barely to a simmer, cover it, let it sit there for half an hour. And then I crush some garlic and put some olive oil and garlic and some herbs and a little bit of salt and pepper in a jar with those tomatoes that are now kind of like a mash,
mm-hmm.
and I stir it. It's like this paste, and I use it as my sandwich spread in the winter. It is so yummy.
Sounds really good.
Yeah, it is. So anyway, it's actually one of the first varieties of cluster tomato, those little on-the-vine tomatoes,
mm-hmm.
and I wait until later in the season when they're really pretty small, and I just quarter them or cut them in thirds and put them skin side down on the dehydrator tray. And they're just candy sweet, and I really like them. If people try to slice their big heirlooms for drying, what they get is tomato juice all over their dehydrator, and
mm-hmm.
like there's no there because there's just not enough pulp. And a lot of people like to use like Roma-type tomatoes for drying,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think their flavor's quite as good. I mean, I guess they can be if they're dead ripe. But finding the right tomato, the right variety of tomato to dehydrate, that I think can be part of the challenge.
Mm-hmm. And these are, for eating as a snack, these are really great.
Yeah, they're good for that, too.
They're really yummy. And I think, you know, dried tomatoes were one of those things that were so overdone in the 80s and 90s that, I'm still full. I'm sure I'm going to want them again at some point, but I haven't really gotten my appetite back for them after eating so much.
So the other things I love to dry pears, and Bosc pears this time of year are just, they are so sweet, it's almost like over the top to have those, you know, the rest of the year. And then I learned about drying persimmons.
Oh, dried persimmons
and
are so wonderful.
Of course, the fuyus are really easy, but what I learned about the hichias, the ones that normally totally mushy to be edible, is that they can be just starting to be soft, and you can slice them and put them in your dehydrator, and that astringency will go away.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
And they're just everywhere. That's a fruit ripe for gleaning.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
No pun intended.
Right. So here's another one that I had tried once and totally failed, and where I had to have the reference book to help me, and that was zucchini chips.
I've wondered about that.
Yeah, because I tried drying zucchini when I knew I was going back and forth to Honduras, and like I needed to bring some green vegetables with me. So I dried some zucchini and took it down there, and maybe it was partly the humidity, but they were bad. I mean, I didn't even want
really
to put them
sad.
In stew. I mean, they just tasted terrible. But then I think I had some commercially made zucchini chips or something in the last few years, and I thought, I got to try this again because those were really good. So I looked at the handy-dandy reference book, and 160 degrees for the first hour. It's like, oh, okay.
So were you doing it lower?
Yeah, because most fruit is done at like 135 to 140, and I figured, oh, vegetables, you know, they're thin, they're, you know, lower temperature. It's like,
no.
Didn't work.
So what sort of result do you get when you dry zucchini in that way?
Well, chips.
Chips?
Yeah. And they're really good.
Just to eat as chips?
Well, I just did a little bit of salt and then I think a little bit of oregano. I mean, I didn't do very much because I wanted to pretty much find out what they were going to be like. And they were tasty. But, of course, then in the winter you could put them in stews or, you know, use them for anything. You know, even a stir fry, I think you could reconstitute them. So, I don't know. But I mostly just wanted to try it just to do for chips.
Do you ever dry mushrooms?
I don't, because I dry what I grow.
Okay,
I don't
sure.
grow mushrooms.
Sure.
But I know people who do. Well,
yeah, some people who go foraging.
My cousins, they are up on Vashon Island in Washington. And my cousin's husband is quite a mushroom hunter. And he built his own dehydrator, too. So one year, everybody got for Christmas like 3 or 4 different varieties of dried mushrooms.
Ooh, how
they
nice.
So good. Yeah. That was a treat.
So for someone who's starting out, let's go back to the basics. Oh, wait, you have one more thing here.
Oh, yeah.
You got the cutest little jar.
Yeah, that is. Again, somebody gave me that, and so I'm recycling it. A little bitty, that's what? That's only like a 4 ounce.
Yeah, I think that's a 4 ounce.
Anyway, little bitty jar with my seedless blackberry jam. I'm one of these people who doesn't like seeds, but I love the flavor. So I just stand there with my food mill. Listening to the radio, always. That's the thing about food preserving. It's a wonderful combination with radio because, you know, your ears are free.
Yeah.
Your hands and your eyes are busy, but your ears
are
free.
Yeah, so you have a companion.
So I listen to good music or radio a lot when I'm doing food preserving. Anyway, so I'm there yesterday morning with my food mill with the blackberries, and I make this. It comes out the texture of like apple butter, but it's blackberry, and I totally love it.
Well, good. Thank you for bringing it.
Oh, sure.
Yum. Yeah. For somebody who is just starting out, let's go back to the basics for them. They need a kettle or a steamer.
For canning.
They need canning jars. They need a couple tea towels. And they need some sort of reference book.
And the funnel and the big tongs.
Right. And so what sort of investment? Are we talking about $100 up front?
Yeah, if you bought everything,
Yeah.
But, you know, you can find some of the stuff at thrift stores and all that. But
and you can share recipes with friends.
But then again, I know people who do prefer to do canning parties. And so they pool that stuff with friends, and then they get together and they do it. In fact,
That's a great idea.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody whose family did it that way. Like, everyone in the family, all the aunts and grandmothers and everybody comes together, and one weekend, they just do everything. Because it's a lot of stuff to haul out of storage and all that.
There's a great story in one of my favorite books, Mary Taylor Simiti's, on Persephone's Island. And every year they have this huge event where everyone comes and they make tomato sauce in just cauldrons.
Wow.
And they save bottles all year long. And then after they pour the hot tomato sauce into the wine bottles and put corks in, they put it into straw to cool.
Wow.
And it's just, it makes me want to live in Sicily.
Wow. Yeah.
And we are just about out of time, Wendy. So when is your next seminar?
Well, I don't have one planned on food preserving.
Oh, okay. I was thinking you were doing one more.
Not that I planned. Yeah.
Okay. How do people find you, get in touch with you?
Well, I do teach through the JC.
In what department? Are you ag?
Yeah.
Agriculture department.
Sustainable ag program. And in the spring, I intend to be teaching organic gardening basics, which is just a little short course on how to garden organically. And then through Santa Rosa Parks and Rec, I've been doing Saturday morning workshops, which is even more, you know, kind of available for people who don't have a lot of time. Little mm-hmm. three-hour workshops on Saturday mornings, all spring long, once a month, on growing, because that's really my main thing. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, when you grow a lot of food, you got to preserve some of it, too.
Well, thanks so much for taking time to come to Mouthful.
Thank
Maybe
you,
we'll
Michelle.
Get you back here in the spring.
Okay.
And I'm going to give you one more little request to think about giving a call in support of KRCB, specifically of Mouthful. 584-2020 is the number. You know, there's always thank you gifts, and we still have some cases of canning jars, which can be yours, so you can get started. Oh, canning jars cost a case of canning jars $7.99, $8.99, $12.99, depending on the
yeah, it depends on a lot on the size.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So,
but, you know, even when you make that investment, I mean, I can't tell you how many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars worth of food I have eaten out of the same canning jars.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, even if it may seem like a bit of an investment, it's so worth it.
Yeah, and you can think of it as a gift from KRCB to get you started on preserving for many, many years to come. Thanks for tuning in. We're going to hear from Laura Hager now. And thanks for supporting Mouthful. Meet me back here next week for another yummy episode of Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. Have a great week.
I'm writing about the Bucaretta. Have to sing about the Bucaretta.
China has been in the news a lot recently, what with the Olympics and the infant formula scandal. Strangely enough, it seems to have seized America's role as the Wild West of laissez-faire capitalism, and no book I've read recently captures its restless spirit as well as Serve the People, a stir-fried journey through China by Chinese-American food writer Jin Lin Liu. As you may have noticed from the opening ceremonies of the Olympics, China is big and nothing is done on a small scale. Lin Liu came to Beijing as a Fulbright scholar and was having a hard time figuring out a way into the culture until she realized that in China, as in France, food is a national obsession. In fact, a traditional greeting, falling out of favor now that most Chinese have full bellies, is, "Have you eaten yet?" Liu's adventure begins when she signs up for cooking school, much to her parents' horror. Cooking is considered a lowly occupation in China, unfit for a budding scholar. Her classmates are barely educated peasants, just off the farm or out of the factory. She discovers that in cooking schools in China, students aren't allowed to actually touch a knife, let alone the wok. They're expected to watch the master cook and take copious notes in hopes of passing the written government exam for being a chef. Fearing that she'll fail unless she gets some hands-on training, Liu convinces one of her teachers to give her private lessons. What she learns in Chairman Wang's kitchen is that for all its go-go glamour, China is still haunted by the horrors of its communist past. Her teacher, who was sent to do hard labor in the countryside as a student during the Cultural Revolution, never wanted to be a chef in the first place. Like all chefs of a certain age, she was randomly assigned to the job by the government. Not that she's complaining. She's a good cook and a good teacher, and soon Liu is wrapping dumplings with the best of them. Having mastered dumplings, she moves on to noodles, signing up as a noodle intern at a small stand, one of thousands in the capital, run by an émigré from the provinces who takes an artisan's approach to hand-cut noodles. Competition on the street is fierce, however, and despite his fantastic technique, he's having a hard time making ends meet. Artists, especially noodle artists, are rarely appreciated in their lifetimes. Noodle intern by day, restaurant reviewer by night, Liu experiences both ends of China's economic spectrum. Later in the book, she meets restaurant entrepreneur Jeremy Lung, chef of Shanghai's Wanpoa Club, an elite eatery where diners spend as much for a single meal as the noodle man makes in a month. You wouldn't think that a food book could so thoroughly encapsulate the experience of an entire country. But Serve the Nation is so much more than one writer's love affair with Chinese food. From beginning to end, it's full of engaging, fully realized characters whose lives, despite their particularity, reflect the struggles of millions of ordinary Chinese living through an extraordinary time. This is Laura Hager for Mouthful. Na, 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 na. Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes.